This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free select DeWalt, Craftsman, or Kobalt tool with purchase of a select battery kit. Plus, get a free Werner 2-foot aluminum ladder when you buy an 8-foot fiberglass ladder. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online, or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
But where did it all go wrong for England? Was it as simple as the fielding? Because it had been all going so well. England has spent 4 years working towards this Cricket World Cup. You always do, but sometimes with England it feels like they spend about 2 years messing around, picking different combinations of teams, and then about 2 years trying to shoot themselves in the foot further. But this time around, they seem to have done it right. They'd built a brand of cricket, whatever that means. In England's case, I think it means whacking the ball as hard as you can and bowling it as fast as you can. They'd done that. If indeed you think that's important. They'd picked a solid base of players. They'd created a team ethos. We even seemed to sort of ride the speed bumps thrown in our way pretty well. The misdemeanours of Alex Hales, which sounds like a sort of vaguely rubbish rom-com from the late 1990s. The misdemeanours of Alex Hales, starring Hugh Grant and Kate Winslet. Maybe, can we pitch that? Can we pitch the misdemeanours of Alex Hales to some sort of studio? After England win the Cricket World Cup, maybe it'll be a great redemption story somehow. Anyway, even that, England seemed to cope with okay. It was dealt with quickly, firmly, and I think crucially it put the team first. I think it sent a big message about what England's attitude, both to themselves and also to the World Cup itself, was going to be. And that's just as important as anything else, quite frankly. So I thought it was all going well. But, you know, things were bound to go wrong. Owen Morgan broke his finger, and we dealt with that fine. It was a flake fracture, whatever that means. I think it sounds highly painful, but apparently it was fine. And he is now fine. And even I, someone who has, no matter what the sport, seen England muck up World Cups enough times to understand that this is how things are done in this country, even I started to believe that we could actually win it. That was going to happen. And frankly, it still might. I'm not here to rip up the rule book, the form book, and say, that's it. England's World Cup chances are over. It's women and children first. Abandon the good ship England and let Captain Morgan go down with it. It's not what I'm here to say. But this was a massive gut check for England. The thought of chasing 349 won't have scared them. That is something this team, who believe they can reach 500, will not be intimidated by. But the way it came about, I think, is what probably worried them. Certainly would have worried me, anyway. Because as a unit, as a team, you sometimes all get a feeling when things are just not right. Warm-up isn't quite the same intensity. You know, the way you... Everything seems to go a little bit wrong. Your whole preparation just feels slightly off. Sometimes it's just the morning of it. Just the hour before play, things don't quite feel right. And I think that fielding performance will have played into that. It must have unsettled them. Because this is a team who produced a historically good fielding performance in their first game against South Africa. And I can't remember an England team making so many great diving stops, whether it be square of the wicket or in the covers, making hard catches look easy in Ben Stokes' situation, making easy catches look hard. He was out of position. But either way, he clung onto it and it was spectacular. Maybe... And this is the only thing I could really put my finger on. Maybe the relief of getting through that first game, all the adrenaline building up to that game, and just getting through it, getting the win and getting into the tournament with a victory. After all that adrenaline was sucked out of their system by the victory, there was this sort of void. And I think everyone's experienced this when you have a big adrenaline-fueled moment, whether it's a fight with your partner or taking a wicket at cricket, scoring a goal, I don't know, watching your favourite band get Christmas number one, anything like that. About an hour later, when the adrenaline wears off, you get this very empty, very drained feeling. And I wonder if that's what England felt like on Monday against Pakistan. And you add into that a team who are pretty mercurial and did manage to turn it on the day. A crowd who were raucous and outshouted the more reserved England fans. It's not uncommon, frankly. And they didn't cope well. They were uncharacteristically sloppy. And they were uncharacteristically edgy and aggro. Chris Woke shushing the crowd after taking a catch. Ben Stokes got involved with that with sarcastic applause from the huddle as well. Jason Roy and Jofra Archer both got fined for their behaviour on the pitch. Joe Root refusing but also sort of talking about the tampering of the ball that was or was not going on, saying, well, I can't say anything because, frankly, you know, we're not really allowed to say anything. I'll get in trouble. England are rattled. England are definitely rattled. But there will be no great inquest, I think. I think the nature of this England team almost means that they don't have to have the inquest. They'll sit down in a team meeting and everyone will put their hand up and say, ah, this was my fault. Because Owen Morgan talks about a meeting they had after the 2015 World Cup, after they'd been eliminated from that, frankly, about halfway through the group stages. And the meeting they had saw everyone blaming each other, going, he wasn't doing this right, he wasn't doing this right, he wasn't doing this right. They will have another meeting and Owen Morgan will sit in it. And what he respects about this team is that they will put their hands up and say, I wasn't doing this right, I wasn't doing this right. There is no greater team than that which takes responsibility for its own failings. And if England really believe that they can be World Cup winners later this summer, this will be seen as a blip and not a dead end.
Love Sport.
Plenty of navel-gazing out of thought and a little bit of working out exactly what went wrong in the England camp today. Let's speak to Andrew Miller from Crick Info, who joins us now. Andrew, is it as simple as saying England fielded badly and that cost them the game?
To be honest, yes. I really do think it is that simple because England was so good. They were so on it in that opening game against Africa, and it was the difference. You know, they lost by 14 runs and they conceded probably, a conservative estimate, 30 runs in the field. So, you know, simplistically, England have got a team that backs itself to chase 350 on any given occasion. They came so close. To be honest, okay, there is one caveat I'll say to that, and that is that Pakistan bowling was vastly improved from the team that was beaten 4-0. Bringing in Wahab Riaz, you know, he's a guy who can get a reverse swing, bowls with serious pace. Mohammad Amir obviously had chicken pox, that didn't play in that series. And Shadab, the spinner, who had hepatitis. So, you know, they had some serious...
some pretty unusual injury problems, you have to say.
Isn't it, Justin? That's Pakistan through and through. I mean, you know, they are the most, you know, it's such a cliche to call them mercurial or unpredictable, but that's what they do. You know, they can be the worst, most abject team on earth one day. And you know full well that they'll get out of bed on a different side the next day. You know, the 105 all out in their opening fixture. And then pile 3-4-8 on the board. I mean, it's what they do. They've done it in countless tournaments before. But England know that, and England know that they are perfectly good enough to bounce back from this.
I wonder, I was minded of that famous meeting that Owen Morgan's talked about after the 2015 World Cup, when everyone basically shouted at each other and said, no, you're Spartacus. I wonder how much of an inquest there will be after that fielding performance, because it's clearly something they pride themselves on usually.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, Morgan made a very interesting point after the South Africa game. In the post-match presentations, he said that England were always looking to experiment in the field, which is a really weird thing to do. It's like, why would you experiment with something so critical? But I think the point he was making is that England are not a side that are happy to settle with just putting one knee down and stopping it in a long barrier and saving a single. They challenge themselves to hurtle in double quick time, you know, maybe get to the ball a split second quicker than anyone would expect, pick it up in a dramatic fashion and execute a run out. And in doing so, they might every now and again overrun the ball and have to go away for four. They're willing, I think, on balance, to recognise the value of that little bit of extra experimentation is worth the jeopardy of maybe conceding the odd boundary or the odd overthrow. But the trouble is, when things go wrong, as they did with the fielding performance the other day, it's contagious. I mean, Jason Roy dropped a terrible catch. There was a bobble in the field that did for Vince. Owen Morgan, first ball of the match, let one through at points that went for four. These things stack up. And after a point, you know, there's no point in experimenting anymore because basically the most important thing is just to keep a handle on it. And you know, England were clearly getting ratty in the field as well. I think the Pakistan contingent, the crowd, were getting on their backs a little bit. But, you know, they'll store it all away. The one thing they've been very good at in the whole of this four-year run is saving away the things that go wrong and using them to their advantage next time. So I'm not panicking. I think there's still plenty of chance for England to get back on the road, but yeah, not the ideal start.
Do you think they were a little bit rattled? Obviously, you mentioned Jason Roy there. Both him and Archer have been fined 15% of their match fee for various different misdemeanours, which, I mean, frankly, see, the punishment seems not to fit the crime, given how minor they were. But I suppose it shows that England weren't necessarily in control of themselves, put it that way.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's something that Morgan will be more concerned about than the actual defeat, to be honest, is that, you know, the England are clearly recognising this is the World Cup now. This isn't the bilateral series against Pakistan. They're not winning 4-0. It's not that situation where, you know, one mistake and you can bounce back and win the series 4-1. But again, the advantage, as I've said all along with this tournament, is it does allow you to make mistakes early. That, you know, we've been sort of running the rule over what the permutations are for getting into the semi-finals. We reckon you can afford to drop three games and still qualify for the semi-finals easily. Mm. So England drop one. I think realistically that means that, you know, I would be astonished, genuinely astonished, if England lost to Sri Lanka or Afghanistan. Bangladesh, obviously lost in 2015, but again, I would be very surprised if they let that one slip either. So there's four wins, and that means they've just got to win one out of India, New Zealand and Australia, and they're into the semi-finals. I mean, you know, if they can't beat one of India, Australia and New Zealand, then, OK, fair cop. We'll have to say they are a bunch of spineless bottlers and they've been leading us down the garden path. But I'm still confident that they will have enough in the tank to get to that semi-final.
Sounds a bit like you've already got that angry column in the can, just ready to go, ready to release at some point.
Well, you know, and this presumably contributes to the angst on the field. I'm sure that all of the England players know that they're going to be judged by what happens in the next 6 weeks. And you know, when you start letting catches through your fingers and boundaries through your legs, it's you can feel the pen sharpening, can't you? But
yeah,
big
sure.
Boys. I'm sure they'll man up and come good.
There was a little bit of talk of Adil Rashid. He's obviously been managing a shoulder injury. We understand for quite some time, actually. He took plenty of tap from the Pakistanis as well. Is that a bit of a concern?
Yes, it is. That is a big concern, actually. Not least for the overrates issue, because England got away with it the other day. Pakistan got penalised for their slow overrate. But it is a major part of England's strategy, is having their go-to leg spinner in a twin spin attack, and you know they can get through the overs quickly, they can hurry up the opposition, and Rashid is such a integral match winning wicket taking bowler for them. And you know, since he took five for in the Caribbean, including four in an over to win an epic game in Grenada, I think he's taken five wickets in the rest of the year. So it is a worry. England have been playing down the niggle, but I wouldn't be surprised. I think they're playing Cardiff next with the slightly strange boundaries. It may be a game that they want to give him a break for and just let him rest up for more strenuous contests to come.
And England also went for the, well, what I was sort of calling the dynamite option. It was a bit like playing two Alangyan, Thok and a Singer in the England rugby team and sticking Bentio in there as well, of playing Mark Wood and Jofra Archer. Do you think that's an attack that does feel balanced?
I'm not bothered by that, to be honest. I was perfectly happy with seeing Wood in there, and to be fair, he bowled very well. Mm. I mean, you know, going for 50 odd in 10 in those circumstances, there's nothing wrong with that. Archer got a bit of tap, which was maybe a surprise, the first time we've seen him really being taken to the cleaners in an ODI so far. But again, he's too good not to come back from that. I don't worry about that. I mean, the thing about Plunkett, who the guy who missed out, is he's clearly a massively experienced bench guy. He's the sort of guy, you know, if someone does wake up one morning feel a bit crook, when suddenly you look and see Plunkett's on the team sheet, you think, oh, that's all right, that's not too bad. So it's not a panic to have him not in the side. It's actually, on the contrary, I'd rather have him as a guy who can come in than maybe, you know, not having Wood in there and feeling you have to throw him in because someone else isn't functioning, if you see what I mean.
Mm, yeah. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. As always, very calming, no panic here. England is still on course for the semi-finals. Andrew Miller there, UK editor of ESPN Cricket Info.
Love sport.
Now, I also want to talk about Andy Murray. He's going to play Queens. He's going to play doubles at Queens with Feliciano Lopez. It's great news. I mean, it's good news, obviously, because you don't like seeing sports people injured. You don't like seeing anyone who wants to do their job not able to do their job, quite frankly. So it's great that he is getting back on a tennis court in a competitive context. It's terrific news. But it's something he's been hinting at for a while. He's never really given up on this desire to return to top-level tennis. But is this top-level tennis that he's coming back to? Because it's been a pretty lengthy journey, almost 2 years since he was beaten by Sam Querrey in 5 sets at Wimbledon. I was at that game, the second half that I watched courtside. And actually the first half I spent watching Novak Djokovic limp through a set against Burdic and then retire with a shot, an elbow injury. Now, I remember reports coming into the court and every now and again the score would flash up on number one that Murray was struggling against Querrey. He'd win a set back or get broken again. You know, people were talking about how he was struggling with injury, he was limping. And I went over to cover the story and I basically got the last 14 games of which he won 2. And it was sad. It was sad to see a man who had achieved so much at Wimbledon, who had done so much for British tennis, then be just brought to his knees. You know, Sam Querrey's a decent tennis player. He really isn't a bad tennis player. He's a big server. He's good on grass, obviously. But to see a guy like Murray struggle so badly against him and against himself, frankly, it was painful. Since then, of course, he delayed surgery, tried to recover sort of organically, if you like, and for want of a better word. Tried to come back, couldn't. He had hip surgery, of course. Tried to come back again, limped out again, had to pull out of Wimbledon before he even played last year, and then had another surgery. That second surgery, the resurfacing surgery, that was a bit of a last gasp. You know, this is a procedure that I think he always knew was possible, because he's had this hip problem for years. It's obviously got worse. But that was a sort of make or break. You know, it was an admission that this isn't going to get better. It's got as bad as it really can be. And if I want to play tennis ever again, I've probably got to do this. And that is troubling for any sports person. When they have to admit their own reality. Their own mortality, even. My worry is that it's now pretty unlikely that we're going to see classic Andy Murray. At his very best, Murray was a grinder. He was never a big server or a classic groundstroke player or a serve and volleyer. He was a grinder. He was someone who always got the ball back. He just made you play the ball so often. And that was what made him so difficult to play against. He was, at times, at his peak, he was the fastest man on court on the tour. The amount of ground he would cover for a guy who doesn't look particularly athletic, but was very athletic. You know, he's sort of slightly awkward-looking, pasty Scottish bloke, and he would streak across court like greased lightning. So that was his skill. That was his great weapon. Quite apart from the return and obviously the backhand, and you know, the serving got better as well. But I think that he will now come back and find himself a very different tennis player. He was never a perfect doubles player. He was never suited to it. So this is not his format. He wants it to be a springboard back to singles. But he's not perfectly suited to doing it. So my concern is that he's going to come back and find himself a shadow of the tennis player he was. And that is an extremely hard situation psychologically for a tennis player to find themselves in. Because a lot of them, and I remember Richard Lee, the Love Sport Drive host, saying this, that the moment he decided to retire was when he realised he could never be as good as he was. He had multiple shoulder problems, and if you've seen the scars, they're horrendous. And he realised he was never going to be as good as his very best self. And he went, well, what's the point? Because as a sports person, you spend your whole life obsessing over being the best version of yourself, of making sure that you can give 60 seconds worth of minute run. And when you realise that that's no longer possible, not because of any limitation of your own motivation or anything, but because your body has given up, because you have given too much of yourself to the sport, at that point, the majority of them go, you know what, there's no point in being 70% me. And I kind of admire Murray for not being part of that, because he's not going to be perfect. Even if doubles goes well and it helps him get back to singles games, he's not going to be the player he was. He's going to be a completely different type of player. He'll have to try and do what Roger Federer did, which is reinvent his game. Didn't make massive changes, but certainly adjusted it to a hyper-aggressive short point merchant. It's just not natural for Murray, so he's going to find it hard. And he might find himself just being a first week of a Grand Slam guy. And does he want to do that? I don't know. But I sort of admire the fact that he's willing to try. Because, and I remember when he had surgery, I think for the first time, he put this Instagram post out with a picture of him as a little boy, you know, with a tennis racket, like his sort of school jersey on. And he said, all I've wanted to do all my life is play tennis. And it breaks my heart that I can't. And you don't see that in sport very often. In modern sport, you don't see many people who are just desperate to play the game. They don't really care about the fashion labels or, you know, the sports drinks sponsors. They just want to go out and hit a ball or kick a ball or throw a javelin. Or I don't even care what sport it is. There's not many people whose sheer passion for the sport shines through. And I know some people don't like Andy. They think he's anyone but England, that he's a bit dour, that he's a bit miserable. But he's a funny, witty, shy, but overwhelmingly passionate bloke. And if you can't enjoy the fact that Andy Murray just loves tennis, what can you enjoy?
Love Sport.
James Gray Show on Love Sport Radio. Just a confirmation there that Jo Konta has become the first British woman since 1983 to reach the French Open semi-finals. She beat Sloane Stephens in just over an hour, 6-1, 6-4. Terrific performance from her. Probably the best I've seen Jo Konta play on the clay court. She'll either play Martic or Verisova in the semi-finals for a place in a first Grand Slam final. I don't think we should necessarily rule her out of that either. She has been playing plenty of terrific tennis on the clay courts this year. No small part down to the introduction of a new coach, Dmitry Zavialov. We heard from George Belshaw from Metro Dakota UK there about his influence and how strong he has been over the last couple of years, or at least last couple of months, I should say. Now, I did want to talk a bit about Anthony Joshua today. Kind of have to, really. Because, of course, he was beaten by Andy Ruiz Jr. at the weekend in one of the upsets of, I don't know, the 21st century, certainly one of the biggest heavyweight upsets that I can remember. People have put it up there with Buster Douglas and Mike Tyson over in Tokyo. I don't think it's quite as big as that. I think maybe in the UK it feels that way because, you know, just what we think of Joshua and what we didn't think of Andy Ruiz. But boxing is a great sport for conspiracy theories. Now, I don't know why, but it attracts more of the tinfoil hat brigade than perhaps any other sport. This week, I have read and heard so many crackpot theories. I can't remember having come across this many conspiracy theories, well, since the last time Donald Trump visited the UK, quite frankly. It's just been head to tail, ridiculous theories. Just to run you through some of them. It's just, I don't know why. Well, I think I know why, actually. I think I know why. We kind of love sport, right? Or at least we're supposed to. We love sport because of the unpredictability of it. Because Andy Ruiz Jr., a bloke who no one really thought could beat Joshua, but maybe a few more in the know people thought he could hurt him a little bit, but no one really thought he could beat him. And he did. Out of nowhere, he's a 3-belt world champion. Unscripted drama. It's why heavyweight boxing is so special. So why are we desperate to insist it was foul play? Why do we try and find something wrong with the person who beat the bloke we like or the bloke we think was going to win? Take Joshua, right? I've read on numerous so-called boxing blogs or sort of low-level social media accounts who call themselves things like the home of boxing and boxing connoisseurs. You're not, by the way. You're idiots. Just making stuff up for clicks so that you can maybe one day sell your little Twitter account for a couple of hundred quid and someone might send you some free Gatorade. Honestly, it's pathetic. And about 1,000 different reasons came up why he lost. Some of them are libelous, some of them are not, some of them are downright lies. One is a claim that he had a virus 10 days before the fight, that he was knocked out in sparring by Ajit Kabayel, who's a sort of European-level fighter at best, who frankly looked pretty shoddy when he beat Derek Chisora. There was also a rumour that he had a panic attack in the locker room and that Eddie Hearn forced him to go on, and that was why Anthony Joshua's dad was confronting him in the ring afterwards, strenuously denied by Hearn, and based on some false quotes from Peter Fury. Now, even if there were real quotes from Peter Fury, I don't know what he would know about the Anthony Joshua fight. So, oh, there was even one, and this comes from Dylan White, who frankly should know better, saying that part of the reason he lost was because he wasn't taking his juice, or steroids is what he's referring to there. Again, strenuously denied by Anthony Joshua, who's been tested by the Voluntary Anti-Doping Agency and the UK Anti-Doping Agency throughout his build-up to the fight and has never failed a drugs test. There was even one, and this is perhaps the one that really took the biscuit, even one post warning Hearn to be careful of mercury-laced boxing gloves, handshakes from strange men, and gases in the vents at Madison Square Gardens because, quote, this is America, this is dirty boxing. That last one is particularly psychotic, and I would urge the self-titled Twitter user, the King of Lagos, to seek medical help because he clearly suffers from some sort of form of paranoid delusion. This happens to a greater or lesser extent to just about every fighter when they suffer an upset. Now, credit, why? Because Joshua has been built up by his team, by the marketing, by all the spin, all the hype, as though he is the greatest of all time. It's been marvellous. Look, credit to the team behind him. They've done a great job. They've spun us all this lovely yarn that Joshua is the greatest of all time. He's a man destined to end up as the unified heavyweight champion of the world. His power knows no bounds. It's a great story from nothing, from prison to this. And it was hard to imagine a person who could beat him. We couldn't even dream up someone who might be able to beat him. And yet, this is the hype man's job, and when the hype gets deflated, when someone is beaten who has been hyped as an unbeatable boxer, then what do? We have to find a reason. Because of what we've been fed, we can't possibly believe that he just made a mistake or got beaten by someone who's better than him on the night. We have to dig out skullduggery. It's classic 2019. It's Trumpian approach to sport. Can't possibly be fair and square defeat. Must be some sort of skullduggery going on. Must be something underhanded. The world's against me. Everyone who says otherwise is fake news. In fact, Ron Lewis, boxing journalist who joined us yesterday on the show, got it absolutely right. He said, I've heard a lot of conspiracy theories, including this crazy one, and there's some irony here, that Joshua rushed in trying to finish it after knocking Ruiz down and got nailed by a left hook to the temple and never recovered. That is the real theory here. And it's not a conspiracy, it's just what happened. Josh tried to finish the fight early because that was the marketing plan. Get a big knockout early on in America, get a big check and move on to the next one. It's as simple as that. And AJ shouldn't, and I don't think he will be, distracted by these conspiracy theories. Because he knows the truth. He won't say it, but he knows that the truth is he got it wrong. And he got undone by a bloke who fought really well on the night. And caught him with a fine shot. That's heavyweight boxing. But now for AJ, he's got to focus. He's got to focus on what's important. And that is recovery. And of course, crucially, improvement. He's almost certainly going to get a rematch with Ruiz Jr. It'll almost certainly be in the UK. Potentially a neutral venue, but I think much more likely. Back over here. Millennium Stadium, November. That sort of thing. It'll be a special night. Every fight night at the Millennium Stadium is. I've been to a couple of them. It's ridiculous. But Joshua must know, and I think he does know, that you learn far more from defeat than you do from victory. And that must be his plan this summer.
Love Sport.
Conducting a little bit of a post-mortem on England's defeat to Pakistan yesterday, their first of the Cricket World Cup. And I thought we'd speak to someone who knows a little bit about the mistakes they made yesterday, because Gary Pratt is on the line, a man, a former first-class cricketer, of course, a Durham legend, and also a bloke who knew one or two things about fielding. Gary, a pleasure to have you on the show, especially as someone who brought me one of my great moments of happiness by running out Ricky Ponting back in 2005. I'm sure you're sick of hearing about it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's great to be on. And
it never
get a little bit tired of hearing about it, but never mind.
Well, I won't bring it up again, honestly, unless Ricky Ponting walks in which case I will have to rub it in his face. Tell me, obviously England, the perfect start to the Cricket World Cup with a victory on Thursday, and then defeat yesterday to Pakistan. Do you think this will really damage their confidence at all?
No, I think it's going to be quite the opposite, to be honest with you. It might just be that kind of kick up the backside that they need, just to make sure they're not invincible. And I'm sure they'll come back bigger, better and stronger than previously. If you just look back at tournaments, whether it's cricket or or football, whatever. Take the Germans, for instance, they never used to play well in the group stages and then always used to win the Football World Cup. So I don't think it's too much to get carried away about. Everyone has bad days, failed and bat and ball. And unfortunately for England, it was against a good Pakistan side on the day.
Do you think that Pakistan side, look, the atmosphere created, it almost felt like a game in Pakistan. You know, it was so raucous at Trent Bridge. Do you think England felt that it was, it almost got to them? They seemed a bit rattled, actually.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those things. Once a couple of misfields and stuff happen, then it tends to kind of go through the side. And it's quite difficult to stop that momentum, really. Same as when things are going well, you take wickets every over type of thing. But when things are going bad, it works the other way as well. But yeah, Pakistan obviously played pretty well, helped by England in the field a little bit. But yeah, you've got to give them credit to bounce back from their first defeat as well.
It's kind of weird that the sort of Jekyll and Hyde nature, you know, Morgan talked about the fielding afterwards. They were so good on Thursday, but probably the best fielding performance I can remember an England side putting in. And then they were so poor yesterday. Can you put your finger on any reason why that might be? Two such different performances.
No, not really. I mean, it shouldn't be happening. But like I say, it's sport and anything can happen. And I guess the world that we live in now, people just expect people to be performing 100% all the time and making no mistakes. And I guess this just shows that people are human and these things do happen. And when they do, it kind of costs you games, really. Mm. But I'm sure they'll not be too worried about it and they'll get up and get on with it in the next game.
England have talked a little bit about trying to be experimental with their fielding. I don't quite know what that means, but, you know, I mean, obviously one of the things you were best at along with your batting was your fielding. And I wonder if you look at this fielding side and see them and go, oh, wow, they're doing something a bit different here. They are really pushing the envelope when it comes to fielding.
Yeah, I don't really know what he means by that, to be honest with you, because obviously if you do the basic stuff pretty well, then you end up winning games with your fielding, which is what didn't happen yesterday.
Mm. Is it about an attitude, though? Is it? I mean, for example, yourself, is it about constantly trying to find a way to earn wickets in the field as opposed to being passive?
Yeah, I guess so. You've got to act upon it, and you've got to kind of get wickets in the field sometimes, because obviously bowlers need to help you out and stuff like that. But you've just got to do the basic stuff right and do it well. And that is what you've got to do in training when you're practicing. Just practice the basics well and kind of don't think too much about getting past that line of trying to invent some new tricks and stuff like that. Just do the basics.
It is one of those two. I couldn't remember. We were watching it in the office, actually, and my producer and I, and I said to him, England have thrown at the stumps a lot today. Like, a lot. They must have shied at the stumps 20 times in an innings, which seemed crazy. Do you think that's one of those moments where you are trying to do a bit too much and you're almost trying too hard?
Yeah, I don't know if there's like a bit of an ulterior motive behind that, to get the ball roughened up, maybe. Just to try and get that reverse swing happening. So, obviously, shying at the stumps is obviously going to land the ball in the footholes on the dry wicket. That could be one for it. But other than that, it is quite a risky strategy to just keep throwing the ball at the stumps, because obviously if you do hit and the guy's in, then it could ricochet anywhere. But if that was the plan, then obviously you shouldn't be getting overthrows and stuff like that, which happened quite a bit yesterday.
Well, exactly. I mean, presumably, you know, you should only really be throwing at the stumps when you've got sufficient cover. But I don't know. Look, they've got to the number one in the world for a reason. Do you think just at the overall World Cup, are you still confident England will make the semi-finals and win the whole thing?
Yeah, definitely. I just think this is like obviously not ideal, and but I do think it will do good for them. Like I say, I'm sure everybody will be well on top of the game in the next game.
Gary, thank you so much for giving us the pleasure of your expertise. As always, that's Gary Pratt there, former Durham cricketer, and of course one of the best fielders I can remember seeing in the county game as well, and a very handy batsman. People don't always talk about Gary Pratt's batting. They always talk about his fielding, but a very useful cricketer and did a lot of very good work for Durham over the years as well.
Love sport.
We're also going to talk now to Hugo Lowell, the sports journalist who covers athletics, because Caster Semenya has been given a lifeline for her career, I would suggest, today by a Swiss court temporarily suspending her new IAAF ruling. Let's try and pick the bones out of it with Hugo. Hugo, can you give us a sort of broad strokes version of what today actually means? Or yesterday even, I should say.
Well, I think it's helpful to recap the last month or so, just because this has become so convoluted. So it all started at the beginning of last month when CAS ruled 2-1 in favour of the IAAF, that's athletics governing body, that female track athletes with naturally elevated levels of testosterone would have to decrease the hormone to compete in certain races at major competitions. And then this was followed by weeks of rancour, but in large part it seemed to have all settled down. The first sign that things probably quite hadn't finished came on Wednesday when Semenya announced she was challenging the ruling at the Swiss Federal Tribunal. And that shook the IAAF. But I think they were unprepared for what came yesterday. And that was, as you say, the tribunal decided those regulations should be suspended pending her appeal. In terms of kind of what are the consequences, it's pretty massive for Semenya, because it means she's free to run the 800 metres, her signature event, without having to undergo any sort of hormone therapy until at least June, and perhaps even until next year's Olympics in Tokyo, depending on how long the appeal process takes. So in all likelihood, she will be defending her World Championship title in Doha later this year, which is pretty momentous.
Look, the timeline of all the events involving Caster Semenya's controversial career, not by her own making, of course. We actually almost couldn't fit it onto one side of A4. It's that lengthy. But looking forward, you mentioned she could defend her world title in Doha. How long, because the IAAF are clearly keen to fight this. Like, it seems to me that they don't want Caster Semenya racing, you know, in her natural state in the 800 metres.
Well, I think the IAAF were very rattled by the decision yesterday. They certainly hadn't expected it, and they certainly hadn't received any sort of formal communication from the tribunal to say, this is our decision. So it kind of caught them on the run there a little bit. I think, as you say, they will fight it. And it was quite telling. I spoke to a senior IAAF official yesterday, and the response was, now we're going to ask for them to cover our legal costs in this next battle. I think that really underscores the extent to which the IAAF think, you know, we played fair in the first couple of rounds. We all agreed that the CAS decision would be final and that there wouldn't be further appeal. Now that CAS has gone over and decided to challenge the ruling, the IAAF, I think, have a heightened sense of aggression and wanting to go after CAS. If it wasn't so previously, it most definitely is so now, I think.
But also, it wasn't as though CAS made a unanimous decision. It was two against one. You know, that suggests that there is still an element of doubt here. The IAAF must have looked at that and thought, well, that's a majority decision. And frankly, if one person's opinion was slightly different, we'd be in a whole different situation here. They can't have been so naive as to think that that would be the end of that.
Well, I think you'd be surprised. I think they really did believe that. And I mean, I think it's important to think about how this all arose, and the IAAF thinks its view is very, is not correct, but it's probably the way to go about regulating female sport. And the IAAF has always sought to limit testosterone levels for athletes competing in women's events, because they argue, you know, athletes with higher testosterone levels gain an unfair advantage. The only reason why testosterone is focused is because it's used in sport as a secondary surrogate marker for sex. And they say we would regulate height or limb length or whatever if they were differentiators of the two groups, male or female. You would use height if, say, 99% of males are taller than 6 feet and 99% of women who are shorter than 5'6" or something. That's how it is for testosterone. And I think it's very difficult, because if we want to separate categories in sport, which I think people do, then the IAAF is left with only two options. Let athletes decide themselves in which category to compete, or to use some secondary surrogate marker. And the IAAF has always believed that these are the only options available to it, albeit that the CAS decision was split 2-1. They thought this would be the end of the matter, because there are only two routes, and they're certainly not going to let any athlete decide which category they want to compete in. So for them, I think it really was done and dusted. And the response of the Isle of Blight official yesterday was really telling of how surprised they were and how they really resented this decision.
Which way the courts will go is sounds a bit like guesswork at the moment because no one quite knows what's going to happen. But the court of public opinion, Hugo, if she say races, let's not say Doha because frankly there won't be that might not be that big a crowd there. But if she does say race in the 800 meters in Tokyo, how do you think she will be received by the public?
I think that's a very good question and one that is very difficult to answer immediately because on the one side you have your die-hard athletic fans who believe there should be some sort of separate categorization. But then in the 21st century, I think it's impossible to ignore this growing trend of wanting more equality. And I think as human beings, we all want to have some way of having some fair play and having an element of wanting everything to be, you know, peaceful and calm. I can't see that this controversy will go away anytime soon. It looks to me like the court of public opinion will be divided, whatever happens. I mean, certainly if she goes on to win Olympic medals or World Championship medals on the Diamond League circuit, there will forever be questions that haunt her as to whether or not she really is eligible to be there and should she be competing against other women.
Just finally, Hugo, what you obviously know this case as well as anyone, if not better. What do you think? Should she be allowed to run in the 800 metres without taking medication?
I think it's a very difficult question because I think you need to balance the needs of sport and then I think you also need to balance the needs of, and I think quite rightly, the idea that, you know, Caster Semenya should be able to run as she was born. I'm not in favour myself of Caster having to take medication, but I do think there needs to be some discriminatory factor that separates men and women's sport. I just think personally testosterone is the way to go because the science around it is unclear.
Hugo, thank you so much. No, thank you so much for you're always very well informed on this. What is a very complicated case. That's Hugo Lowell there, sports journalist who covers athletics. Of course, the news yesterday that Caster Semenya will not, at least for the moment, need to take testosterone-reducing medication to compete after a Swiss court temporarily suspended the new IAAF ruling.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.